I'm pulling my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the drive to work. Okay, so today's topic was requested from my blog. I was asked about the evolution of top-down and bottom-up design. So I want to go into what they mean and talk about where magic design used to be and where it is now. Real quick, let me define my terms so people know what I'm talking about. So a top-down design means that usually the beginning and the core structure of your set is built around flavor. The easiest way to think of this is if I took all the names off the cards, would the thing that holds the set together, would the connective tissue of the set make sense? Would you understand what's going on without the names and flavor? A bottom-up is the reverse. It's one where you sort of start mechanically, and the core of what you're doing is mechanical. Let me give some examples. Innistrad is an example of a top-down set. It's based on Gothic horror. And the themes of the set, caring about the graveyard, caring about monster typal, caring about death, those are all things that just play into the general theme of a Gothic horror. But let's say I stripped all the words off the cards. I just replaced them with, or they're just blank. And I took all the words that had flavor, like, vampire, and just replaced them with type 1 and type 2 and type 3 and type 4. You would look at Innistrad and you would sort of say, there's connective tissues and the allies connect in a way with creature types, and okay, it cares about when things die with Morbid, and there's stuff in the graveyard, and maybe you would piece together a little bit like, okay, maybe it's a graveyard set. What makes it hold together is going, the reason that this type has all the creatures and builds up over time is they're zombies. The idea is that a lot of the flavor that comes from Innistrad, that the mechanics can have a flavor component, and a lot of the flavor of how the mechanics work is all tying into this idea of Gothic horror. That if you played Innistrad minus all the names, it would seem a little more disconnected. Where something like original Ravnica, yes, there's flavor, like we flavored each, but it's very clear that we're caring about two color pairings, and that, if you look at sort of how it's structured, even if you don't understand the guilds at all, you do get, it's built around two color pairs. Now, the reason one of the things is I like to, I've been talking about design forever, and top-down versus bottom-up is just slightly different. It has a lot to do with sort of structurally how we build things. And you go back in the day, so the way when Magic first got designed, the creative components usually were a bit secondary. Like, you would make a set and make the mechanics, and then after you sort of had the general gist of your mechanics, you would then flavor it. You didn't tend to, and especially early Magic didn't do a lot of top-down design. A little bit like Arabian Nights was clearly top-down design. Richard was building to the story of 1001 Arabian Nights. But mostly in the early days, most sets, I guess some of the very early sets had flavor elements. Legends was built around characters from their role-playing games. The Dark, definitely, it was built around a mood and a tone. But a lot of early Magic sets, and early Magic, there was a little less connective tissue. Starting around, even Ice Age, this is the idea that, okay, we're going to have mechanics that are going to run through. Like, Legends had a few mechanics. It introduced stuff like Gold and Legendary, but, as far as, like, connective tissue mechanics, it wasn't quite structured like that. Whereas you start getting to Ice Age, where it's like, okay, we're playing around with cumulative upkeep, and more like we're building around mechanics and seeing what mechanics can do, and we're doing more of mechanical exploration. So in early Magic, a lot of what happened is the design team sort of did their design, and then later in the process, you would start building in flavor. Now, it's not that, by the way, it's not that the design team was not thinking at all of flavor. I know for Mirage, which was called Menagerie when they built it, and that the idea of an African setting was pretty early on. Although you'll notice that the way Mirage works, it is not like the setting is organic to the mechanics. You know, mechanics are flanking and phasing. I mean, it's not... It was a lot more like, we're going to build something mechanically, and maybe we'll think about creative, but the interspersing of the two in the early days of Magic was not a big thing. Now, it is true, when we were building Tempest, Michael and I had pitched the Weatherlight Saga. Now, we had built Tempest without knowing what the story was. We built it mechanically. But there was a period where I'm like, okay, we want to tell a story, and I figured out how to interweave our story around the components that I knew existed. You know, the slivers became a component of the story. Shadow, that meant something. So we made it mean something in the story. So it definitely, Tempest was the first that I can remember where there was a conscious story, and the same people that were doing the mechanics were interacting with the story, me being the major person. So Tempest definitely was the first set that at least tried to make sure the story reflected what was going on in the mechanics. That things that show up in the mechanics at least show up in the story. Now, the Weatherlight Saga sort of, behind the scenes, I've taught this many times, there was kind of a schism. I was the liaison between the story and the mechanics, and when I got sort of disconnected from that, there was a period of time where we would design stuff, and then they would make whatever creative they wanted. Like, there was a lot more disconnect. The classic example is Urza Saga. We made an enchantment-based theme, and the creative team called the year-long cycle the Artifact Cycle, the Artifact Saga. So there's some disconnect, or Artifact Cycle. There's some disconnect there. But, so, when we get around that age, what started happening was we would talk to the creative people, we would understand the basics of what was going on, and then we would make sure that we'd, like, make the characters. You know, we'd at least do a few things that hit upon the story. But it was very light. Mirrodin, I mean, I guess during the actual making of Tempest, when we were making Wrath, the setting of Tempest, for the first time ever, we brought in a team. And there was a lot more working between that team and the story team at the time, because I was involved. Then there was kind of a schism. There was less involvement. I think the next big time is in Mirrodin. We had sort of got a new creative team. Brady Domremuth, actually, technically Tyler was in charge, but Brady Domremuth was there. The sort of modern world building, as you will. Mirrodin clearly was the example where I'm like, okay, I wanted to do an artifact set. The idea of Mirrodin was we were going to do a block that was tied to artifacts. And I went to them and said, okay, let's go build a world. Let's get off this plane. Let's go build a world. And the idea is, hey, the set is going to be about artifacts. Let's build a world that reinforces that. And so for the first time, really, the sort of modern back and forth that happens between creative and design, where you know, we would say something and we'd get feedback. And so now that was the earliest version. I think a lot of mechanics was sort of locked in on Mirrodin, but we did go back and forth and talk a lot about what the creative can show. Then after Mirrodin, so Bill Rose was the head designer at the time. Bill really says, hey, so much of what we do now is we build mechanics and then figure out flavor afterwards. What if we built flavor first? So the idea of Champions was they spent some time figuring what they wanted. I think we narrowed it down to Japanese mythology or Egyptian mythology. Ended up going with Japanese mythology. At this point, Brady was in charge of the creative team. Brady and his team did a lot of research into Japanese mythology, and they built a cool magic world influenced by Japanese mythology. And then, after that was built, like they built the world first, the design team led by Brian Tinsman then sort of crafted a mechanic or crafted a mechanical identity tied to the flavor. And the lessons of Champions of Kamigawa was, it turns out that creative is just way more flexible than mechanics. And if you look at Champions of Kamigawa, it's very what we call parasitic, that a lot of the way the mechanics ended up is, this is a samurai. All samurai have the Bushido mechanic. This is a snake, whatever snake people were called. They had the thing where they, when they deal damage, they didn't tap the next turn. And the moon mist bounced things to your hand. Like, there very much was like, these things are all all connected creatively, and so mechanically we'll give them all the same mechanic. And it definitely was a bit limiting. It didn't do a great job of, I mean, the original Champions Black had some mechanical issues. But that's the first time, I mean, outside of like Arabian Nights, clearly, that we did, but as far as building our own world, not adapting an existing world to somebody else's. I mean, even Legends sort of adapted to the D&D games that they had played. Champions was the first time we said, okay, we're making a brand new magic world. It's uniquely a magic world. It has the properties we need for a magic world. You know, we have a thing when we design worlds now, we call it the grid. And what the grid says is, hey, in all the colors, do we have all the sizes? Do we have small, medium, and large creatures? And then in the appropriate colors, also flying creatures. Like, we fill this grid out like, oh, does the world have the things the set will need? But okay, so we learned from Champions. The big lesson from Champions was, okay, look, you have to be more back and forth. That you can't do creative first and then just do mechanics after. It doesn't work well. So after Champions of Kamigawa is Ravnica. So the interesting thing there is, I think Ravnica. So when Bill Rose and Randy Bueller made me the head designer, so when I got promoted to head designer, Bill felt it was really important that I not only be head designer, but that I oversee the creative team. So when I got made head designer, in addition to my head designer responsibilities, I was made manager of the creative team. And I think Bill's philosophy was, hey, he saw kind of what happened in Champions of Kamigawa. He's like, look, I guess if we're going to make it work, if we're going to make sets sort of really sing, we need the creative team intricately involved with the design. It can't be after the fact. So Ravnica is a really, really good example, probably the first major example, where the creation of the world and the set started from back and forth between design and creative. Now, that was aided by the fact that I was leading the design and I oversaw the creative team. So, as Bill envisioned, I guess. And like I said, I'm very proud. I think Ravnica. So, the key of Ravnica was me coming to the creative team very early and saying, hey, here's my initial idea. And I mean, regular listeners have heard the story infinite times. The real short version is, Invasion had done what was the first multicolor block, the first sort of themed block. We wanted to go back and do multicolor again, very popular theme. I didn't want to be Invasion. Invasion was all about playing all the colors with Domain and such. So I'm like, okay, I want you to play as few colors as possible, but still be multicolor. So that meant two. So I went to the creative team and said, look, here's my parameters. I want to play with all 10 two-color pairs, and I want to treat them equally. I don't want to treat ally better than enemy, which is how we, at the time, did it. That's the only thing I said. I went to creative team and said, okay, let's start with that premise. Brady then absorbed it, went home, like, while exercising one day, came up with the idea for the guilds. And the idea of a city. Guilds in a city. And so the idea that Brady brought forth, which was pretty groundbreaking in a lot of ways. But the idea is, okay, I was saying, hey, let's have 10 component pieces. Brady was, let's make those factions and make them flavored. That each faction will have a flavor. And because we're using the color pie, and that the color pie has a lot of flavor, okay, what happens when you join white and blue? Blue and black, black and red, red and green, green and white, white and black, blue and red, black and green, red and white, and green and blue. What happens when you join those together? And that each one of those could have an identity. Then the interesting thing, so what's happening there is, while this is all going on, we are doing design work. So one of the early things we did was, I knew I'd come up with hybrid during, like, exploratory didn't exist yet, but I was doing a lot of thinking before we started the set on my own, and I came up with hybrid mana, which I was very excited by. So the very first playtest was all 10 color pairs and hybrid mana. And after the playtest, Henry Stern, so real quickly, Henry Stern came in second at the U.S. Nationals in 1995. He came in third at 95 World Championship and the 96 World Championship. He was top four back-to-back years. So Henry was a very good player. He was the first sort of pro we hired. At the time, we didn't even think of hiring him as a pro at the time. That was later we started, oh, we should hire pros on the Pro Tour. He was looking for a job. I thought he'd be good at Magic. You know, we were friends. I recommended him to Bill and Randy, or I think Bill was before, no, Randy wasn't here yet. I recommended him to Bill. Anyway, he came to me after the playtest and said, Mark, that made my brain explode. The number, I had to have piles for every two-color pair, every monocolor, every hybrid color, artifacts. Like, he's like, I don't even know how many piles I had. And he goes, look, I came in second at the U.S. National Championship. I came in third at back-to-back Worlds. I'm a very, very good Magic player. This was beyond me. There was too much going on. And so I'd gotten that information from the playtest, that we just had too much going on. And then Brady came back with the idea of, what if we made factions? And those two things together made me come up with the idea of, well, what if we don't put all of them in the same set? What if a set just had some of the factions? And that's when I came up with the idea of doing originally the 4-3-3. Large, small, small. Large set would have four guilds. First small set would have three guilds. Second small set would have three guilds. But my point here is that the only reason I was able to come up with that idea was I was bouncing off of Brady's idea of the guilds. And really what happened was, and this is a great example of how the process works now, we had a mechanical component. Creative came back with a creative, like creative responded to our mechanical component. We then mechanically respond to their creative component. And we started this whole message of back and forth. Now, technically speaking, if you look at original Ravnica, it was my example of a bottom-up set, it is mechanically built around factions, mechanically, like, the way you build a Ravnica set is you want each of the factions to overlap mechanically with the factions that share colors that are in it. Because we want the ability to go, I'm going to draft blue cards. Which guild with blue should I play? Should I play both of them or one of them? Or, you know, we want to give you options of where to go. And so at its core, the way Ravnica is structured happens to be mechanical. The core is mechanic. So it is a bottom-up set. But, and here's where this is important. As we start getting into Ravnica, the idea of what is a bottom-up set and what is a top-down set, before Ravnica, it was pretty obvious. It was very loud whether we were bottom-up or top-down. Because that, like, usually when we were doing up top-down and bottom-up before we got to Ravnica, it was like one team did its work first, and then the second team adapted to the work of the first team. You know, when Richard was building Arabian Nights, like, okay, like the world was fleshed out for him. And so he was trying to mechanically capture the world of Arabian Nights. Or when we did Champs of Kamigawa, we made the world first and then mechanically tried to capture the world. And Mirrodin was a nice example where building the world at least took into mind the idea of what the mechanics were. But I think Ravnica is really the idea where there's back and forth. And I think the nice thing about Ravnica is it's not like there's not infinite flavor in Ravnica. It is not as if the mechanics don't really carry the flavor. But, so anyway, let's advance through time. So, Innistrad is another good example. So Innistrad, we decided we want... So Innistrad was inspired by the making of Odyssey. Brady and I talked during the making of Odyssey, and this is when Brady was an editor, not in charge of the creative team. We talked about how it was weird that the Odyssey was all about the graveyard, but the story, which was about Oteria and people fighting for magic in the pits, and anyway, it had nothing to do with the graveyard. I mean, it literally had nothing to do with the graveyard. And I think Brady was like, you know, we could have made a whole set that reflected the graveyard. Like, we could have made a horror set. That the genre of horror and the graveyard seemed like a perfect pairing. And I kept that idea with me, and it took a while to get made, but eventually we made Innistrad, and I did exactly that. Like, Innistrad is, I think, the modern day, like, the sort of, the stake in the ground of the first modern top-down set. We're like, okay, we're going to take this idea of what we want, but we're, from the earliest possibility, we're going back and forth of building the world. And the perfect example was we realized early on that we wanted monster typal to be a thing. And originally we were going to do vampires, werewolves, and zombies. Those are the three that came to mind. And then what we realized was, as we were trying to plot out where to put the different creature types, we liked the idea of zombies being in blue and black because there's two types of zombies. There's things you use necromancy to raise from the dead, and there's like Frankenstein, like science. You use science to raise them from the dead. And one felt black and one felt blue. It's like, okay, we can put zombies in black and blue. And we like the idea of vampires in black and red, the like blood-hungry vampires. And then as I started realizing, like, we were trying to put them in different categories. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, we started realizing maybe we could do a typal theme where we run them through ally color pairs. And when I was working with werewolves, like, everything wanted to be black, but everything couldn't be black, right? So I'm like, well, werewolves are really about sort of this idea of repression, of that I have these feelings and emotions, but I have to lock them up. But at night, my monster comes out and I do the things I do, and I, you know, like, the idea of the werewolves as being unrestrained, and what, like, make them green and red. Werewolves, probably in a vacuum, would be green and black. But we're like, okay, look, we have a lot in black. Let's try green and red. So we went to the creative team, and I said to them, hey, it's two things. One is we needed something for, if we put the humans in green and white, the idea for white and blue was, okay, what if we do ghosts or spirits? So it's like, okay, we need ghosts. And then we sort of said, hey, here's where we need them color pie-wise. And hey, we need werewolves in green and red. So the creative team were like, okay, let's figure out how to express werewolves in a way that really plays that up. And really took the theme we were talking about repression and, like, the idea of, you know, becoming your werewolf as you just living life as you want to live it rather than how you feel you must live it. And that red and green very much are the two colors being opposite blue. Blue is all about planning and thinking things through, and red and green are about acting. Living on impulse, on instinct. Like, what if werewolves were all about, you know, impulse and instinct, just doing what they wanted to do? And that felt really cool. But it meant the creative team had to respond to that, right? And so we start getting in a pattern where the idea of building something is not one team works first and the other team then responds to it. It's a lot more of there's back and forth that goes between the two teams. And the teams riff off one another. And that general consensus has held. The idea of, like, for example, there is now world-building exploratory, and there's design exploratory design. And that a lot of what both want to do is understand the core dynamics. Like, a lot of exploratory is, design figures out what design needs, world-building figures out what world-building needs. And then we come together and say, well, design, we're thinking of this. And exploratory world building as well. World building, we think we need this. And each side can talk about the things that they need. Now, the biggest wrinkle, because one of the things that I think is tricky is the reason this podcast topic came up is the question you asked me is, wow, everything's top down now. Are you going to do bottom-up sets again? And what I realized was, it wasn't that we aren't doing bottom-up sets. It's that the nature of how we do things and how we market things has changed. So, back in the day, the way we would plan future sets was I would do something where I would make what's called the 5-year plan, which is sometimes a 6-year plan, sometimes a 7-year plan, where I would say, hey, as the head designer, I was plotting out sort of where I thought there were fun design spaces. And some of the time I was thinking, like, some of the inspirations did have a creative element to it, like, we're going to do a set based on horror. And sometimes it's very mechanical. We're going to do a set based on land mechanics. But it was very high concept. It was very much going, okay, I think the through line of design will be this thing. It was very, very design oriented. Not that I didn't keep in mind what creative was doing. And part of the process was when I would make my initial pass, we'd show it to the creative team. And sometimes the creative team would go, hey, we just can't do that. The classic example was I had a world where we visited, the first set was prehistoric. The second set was like same world, but jumping ahead thousands of years was like medieval. And the third set, jumping ahead thousands of years, was like as futuristic as magic wanted to be at the time. And like Brady said, look, we can't do that. That's three worlds. That's not, you know, jumping ahead thousands of years between a prehistoric and a medieval world. I mean, maybe there's some slight through line because it's the same world. But as a general rule, we're building three worlds. Our team's not built up to do that. So we ended up audibling and did Theros instead, for example. But what has happened over time is we now have what we call an arc planning group. I'm not the sole person making suggestions of what to do. I'm part of the team. But we have more members of the team. We have Doug Beyer, who represents the creative, and Jackie, that represents Jackie and Doug together. We have Roy that does the story, and Aaron's in these meetings. We have people representing the franchising. Like, we have people that are ribbing all the different facets of what makes magic magic. It is not, it's far from one person saying, hey, what about this? It's a whole team. And the other thing that we do is we do a lot of research now. That we don't just pick a thing in a vacuum. We take it and we'll run focus groups and we'll see what people think of the idea. Like, we do actual market testing on the ideas to see what people think. And the other big thing is when you're doing market testing, it is a lot easier to market test creative elements than it is mechanical elements. And the reason is it takes a long time to make a mechanical element. Like, if we want to make something, we have to work on it for months and months and months and months, sometimes years, to get to the final version. So it's kind of hard to test mechanical things. We don't have the finished mechanical property, where it's a lot easier to test creative things. You know, get an artist to draw a picture, and that it just takes a couple pictures to get the essence of what we're going for from a mood and tone. And the other big thing we've learned over the years is, so there's two big parts of magic sales, what we call sell-in and what we call the tail. Sell-in means how much we sell originally. Like, when the product first comes out, we sell a certain amount of products to all the stores. Usually, the lion's share of how a set does is based on the sell-in, right? When we sell the product, how much gets bought? Like, in the first couple weekends, how much gets bought? When the set first comes out. And why that? Like, that's when all the marketing happens. It's when, I mean, it's when the key excitement, the pre-release happens. It's when there's a focus on the new set. Right. And obviously, when there's a focus on the new set, it's coming out and all eyes are pointed toward it. That's the time period that it's going to do the best. Tail is how well it does over time. Like, when we make a product, we print it for several years. And so people can order it again. Once you sell out, you can order more. So a tail has to do with how well a set does over time. What we've learned over many years is that the creative component is more responsible for the success of the sell-in. Are people excited by the idea of the set? And that if the idea is enticing and exciting, that tends to be the thing that greater dictates how the set sells initially in sell-in. The tail of the set is very, very tied to the mechanics of the set. Do people like the set? Are there cards people want to own in the set? Like, a lot of the tail is how successful the set is mechanically as a set. Do people enjoy playing it? But since we've learned that the sell-in is a lot more about sort of the flavor of the set, and the tail is a lot more about the mechanics, our marketing for the sell-in, our marketing for the release, has gotten more and more about the flavor and less about the mechanics. Like, once upon a time, when we would put, we advertised a new set, we're like, here's the new mechanic. We'll show you a card. Like, that's how we advertised it. And what we realized over time is what really excites people in the sell-in has to do with the concept. What is it? And a lot to do with the art, and, you know. So what that means is, as we do planning right now, we're very, very conscious of what is the concept of the set. That when we go to sell you a set, that there has to be something that has a visual component that you can understand, you can grok. Now, will we mechanically make that true? Will we make the gameplay match the flavor of what is being sold by the flavor? Absolutely. But because the flavor is sort of how we lead in our marketing, we now sell sets more on flavor in their initial thing than we do in mechanics. It's not that we don't, I mean, we tell you the mechanics, we show you the mechanics, we design sets such that the mechanics will be exciting. My team, my team's entire job is to make exciting Magic sets. And I mean, all of design. All of design, the goal is to make exciting Magic sets. We want them to play well. And a set that looks really cool but doesn't play well is not great. And the one of the reasons that people feel, the people that can look at the flavor and get excited is, hey, we do a good job of delivering on what we're doing. If Magic just made clunker after clunker after clunker, people start getting skeptical. Oh, this looks cool, but oh, Magic keeps putting out clunkers. Like, we have to keep delivering. So it's not that we can't mechanically deliver every time. It's important to us we do. Yeah, I spent a lot of time and energy. I and many other designers spent a lot of time and energy on that. But I think what happens is, because the focus is a little bit more on the flavor and how we sell it, it feels more like every set is a top-down set, because top-down sets are about flavor, and we're selling the set on flavor. The reality is, how we build the set, what the core structure of the set, there are some sets that have a core structure that are flavor, there's some that have a core structure that are mechanics. We still do make top-down or bottom-up. My point, though, is it's really, really hard to tell from the outside. My classic example is Bloomburrow. Bloomburrow, early on, was like, okay, we're going to do this anthropomorphic animal set. We understood our inspirations. But the way we structured it was to make 10 two-color pairs built around the animals. Now, that's not to say that we didn't choose the archetypes carefully. It's not to say we didn't try to pick mechanics that, you know, it's not a mistake that the go wide, make a lot of tokens animal is the rabbit. That makes a lot of sense for the rabbit, you know. We were, you know, the sneaky one is the rat. I mean, we were very careful of making sure that the animal we did in the gameplay lined up. But the core, the way that Bloomburrow is built is, let's make 10 factions and then make sure the factions interconnect so that you can draft well. It's a very, very mechanical structure. So Bloomburrow is very much a bottom-up design. Even though the set is super flavorful, it's super, like, and that's where I think a lot of the confusion comes from, is we've just gotten really, really good at the back and forth between creative and flavor, to the point at which it is hard to understand whether something's bottom-up or top-down. I mean, if you really get into it and you look at it, I mean, there's some clues and such, but we build sets such a way now that it's just not easily apparent what it is. That if we do our job correctly, hey, maybe you shouldn't even know if it's top-down or bottom-up. The reason that term exists is me explaining to all of you how we make things. Like, it's a design term. It is not really a consumer-facing term. We don't sell a set, you know, or at least nowadays we don't sell a set. This is a top-down set. This is not how we sell sets. We sell it on the flavor that it is, regardless of whether it's top-down or bottom-up. And I think that's a lot of the confusion, is that it's not that behind the scenes that we don't do things in a way that can be divided up. It's that from the front facing, it's hard to tell that. So it's not, we're not going down in the number of bottom-up sets. Probably it's about the same. I mean, I will admit, early in Magic, we did a lot more bottom-up just because we weren't doing a lot of top-down. And we do more top-down. It's 50-50-ish these days. But that is what's going on. It's not really that we've changed how we make Magic. It's not different how we structure things. The idea of top-down, the idea of bottom-up, still is sort of true. But it's subtler, and it's not as easy to understand. Like, the finished product hides it a lot better than it used to. The finished product is going to be super flavor. The mechanics and the flavor are going to intermesh so much that it's going to seem like, oh, it's all top down. Look how much they mesh together. That's just how we do things. Even bottom up sets will mesh them together. And that's really my topic for today. It is not so much that we've changed how we make magic sets structurally. I mean, we have changed how we interact with the creative team. We have changed how we build sets. There's a lot more back and forth, and the creative elements are taken into account much earlier in the process. But that said, the core structuring, I mean, that part has not necessarily changed, but the end product and the way it looks to all of you have changed. So that is my note of today, is that top-down and bottom-up does technically exist, but in a real technical sense, in a way that I'm not sure it means as much anymore. I don't know the audience being able to identify the difference means anything. I mean, you have to be pretty into really into magic design, understanding the core of magic design to understand the differences there, or be able to recognize the differences. So, anyway, guys, that is my topic today, the history of top-down and bottom-up. I hope this was interesting, but I'm now at work. I've actually been at work for a few minutes here, but I got in and I was excited in what I was saying. I do that from time to time. I talk. People sometimes will see me, like, my car's parked and I'm just chatting. They're like, oh, he's doing this podcast. Anyway, guys, I am at work, so it is time. It is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.